Welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. I'm Gemma Rosenthal and my business is Creative Hearts. I'm a singer, songwriter, dancer, actor, choreographer, poet, many creative things, and I'm also a creative life coach, and I help you to find your voice and live your most creative life. On this show, we talk about everything storytelling, and my co-host is
Chris Sissons, and my business is Market Together. I'm a local marketing coach specializing in the use of stories for marketing, business development, and finding the real work only you can do. On today's show, we will be exploring jazz, getting married across cultures. We'll be looking into the margins in books and in life generally. And we'll be hearing a love song, because this is the day after Valentine's Day and we're all recovering from that. So Gemma, who are we welcoming as a guest today?
Yes, today we are delighted to introduce our guest, Lincoln Knoll, who is the maestro, a jobbing professional pianist and piano teacher. Since graduating from the Royal Academy of Music in London, Lincoln has enjoyed a wide and varied career, which has included the concert stage, West End theatre, care homes, and most of all, weddings and events. His work has taken him UK-wide, and he simply loves playing for the people and giving them magical experiences. Born in Northampton, Lincoln began playing at age of 3 and was inspired to pursue his dream by watching pianist Liberace, Oscar Peterson and Daniel Barenboim on television, and the great violinist Yehundi Mnuchin, sorry if I get some of the names wrong, who he first saw live at age 6. During lockdown, he has been in huge demand, creating commemorative musical video telegrams for people's special occasions such as birthdays and anniversaries. He's just recovering from an intense stint of recording lots of those for Valentine's Day. He describes his greatest achievement as being able to access people at all levels of society through music. For him, it's a special privilege. Lincoln still lives in Northampton, is football mad, and is married to Anne-Marie and has 2 beautiful teenage daughters. Welcome, Lincoln.
Thank you very much. It's fascinating hearing my life coming back at me. It's it's a strange sort of feeling. Yeah.
Does it make you feel proud of yourself and your achievements?
I was actually thinking he's not bad. and then you said, Lincoln, do you feel proud of yourself? So I thought, actually, yeah, I should say. Yeah, I do feel proud. Of course I do. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. You've got a lot there. It's a, you know, wide range of things that you have done. So, yeah, you started playing at age of 3. That's really young to start playing the piano.
As a piano teacher, I had an inquiry at the weekend from a mum who said, my daughter is 5 and keen to play. Now, I would always give kids the benefit of the doubt, but I've noticed, because, obviously I've got girls of my own, is that kids these days, it's harder for them to display individuality and to shine. Head teachers have got the brief that they want everybody to shine. So if you're a particular student, pupil, that has an exceptional talent, I think that a normal kid going through the normal channels of state school life, which most of us did, would probably struggle. I often wonder, and I was wondering while you were reading all those bits and pieces about me, if I lived now, if I started school in September 2022, what sort of direction my life would have taken, given the breaks that I was given by certain teachers at certain points, because teachers were always looking and executing certain decisions based on a particular individual circumstances. And we are now sort of thinking more of the collective. I'll give you an example. When you go to see your bog standard nativity play, there isn't a Mary and a Joseph, three wise men and three shepherds who all have a line. Everybody's in the show. So, you know, if Joseph is actually a Laurence Olivier in the making, we're not going to probably spot it until he has lost interest and drifted somewhere else. But that said, I mean, at the age of three, my dad set out to teach himself to play the piano, and I looked over his shoulder and was picking it up faster than he was. I also had a cousin who was immensely talented. He probably should have been the pianist. Unfortunately, Elson is no longer with us. But 12 years older than myself, he was sitting at the piano and playing pieces that impressed me. At the same time, I had it's Daniel Barenboim. He was on TV. Liberace was on TV. And I saw Yehudi Menuhin live. And this was a guy who was also on TV. The other thing to say is that in 2022, kids are not watching live musicians as default. I mean, BBC One, BBC Two. I mean, Gemma, you're a young thing, but Chris will know that in the old days, you know, you had BBC One and ITV, and if you had a certain type of aerial, you went upstairs and watched BBC Two. And Channel 4 didn't come until much, much later. And all of that music was live on TV. Yes. Every game show featured a group of musicians and a musical director who was waving his arm. So the default position for music was to see the guys playing. I know we're going to talk about weddings later, but the thing that I noticed with weddings when I started doing them really, really intensely is that kids were looking for the switch, the on switch, the plug. And that's not something that my friends did. They just saw the music coming out of the piano. But today's kids are looking to see where it's coming from. You know, where is the internet lead? Where is the remote control? Where is the switch? You know, creating music that just comes from self. You know, you're a creative person. It comes from somewhere inside. And kids are not really seeing that process now. It's in its simplest form. I know that there are all sorts of programs, Strictly. We've got the X Factor, Pop Idol, Britain's Got Talent. But the emphasis is on the parody and not the creativity. They are great programs, don't get me wrong. We sit like every other family in Middle England and watch them and enjoy them and derive great pleasure and great value from spending time as a family having a shared experience. But I kind of feel, I don't want to sound like a cynical old man, but I do kind of feel a little bit sad that creativity is getting lost down the pecking order of priority, as opposed to the results-driven society that we have become.
I think it's in part to do with the automation of so much of society. And I was in hospital yesterday morning. Nothing serious. It's just being checked. Old age brings these things on, but I noticed that a lot of the questions I was being asked were about my lifestyle, as opposed to any condition that I might have, because doctors know that their approach to treating something does depend a lot on the person's lifestyle. And one of the things, and it's I haven't got the details, but statistically, they found that people respond to treatments a lot better if they have a doctor assigned to them. And not everybody, but many people are finding now that that they haven't got a named doctor. They're just part of a particular practice. So they never see the same person twice or more successively. My doctor retired and I haven't been given a replacement. Still going to the same practice. And I think a lot of people are finding that. And statistically, they've shown that people don't respond to treatment so well under those conditions, because there's a relationship that builds between you and your doctor. And you perhaps, when you experience it, you don't think much of it, but apparently it does have an effect. And I think that's part of the same alienation from the, you know, from human interaction, isn't it?
And human creativity,
yeah,
which I suppose is what we're about, or what certainly Gemma and I are about. And people are struggling more and more these days. I get asked more questions about, so you are a pianist and a piano teacher. How does that work? You know, I didn't get, when I was seven and I told my my football coach that I wanted to play a pianist, he got it. He understood it. He didn't know how I was going to get there, but he understood it. He knew people on the television. He could name a man that he'd seen on TV who played the piano. He could, you know, he knew who Elton John was.
Mrs. Mills.
Willie Flatwell. We you know, these people were there. And I hasten to add that when BBC, to use an example, BBC Young Musician of the Year was first shown, it was shown at primetime television on BBC One. The last BBC Young Musician of the Year was on the iPlayer, and I didn't know it was on until it had finished. I watched it back on playback, which is fine. But when BBC Young Musician of the Year was on TV, everybody had a view on it because everybody knew it was there. Whether they watched it, they absorbed it the way I did, because obviously I'm a musician, but they had an interest and there was an awareness. But that's, you know, that's the kind of the state of the world. So coming back to your original question, Gemma, about being free and playing, it wasn't so unusual because, as Chris knows, at that time, people were used to being able to do a turn. It was a thing. You either sang a song, recited a poem that you memorized, but people weren't so reliant on being entertained. They created, and there's the word created, they created their own entertainment. You know, people of a certain age. I mean, yesterday, being Valentine's Day, I played in one of my Valentine's contributions to a group of people who were aged between 75 and 100. And they were able, in the space, to create magic for themselves through community singing, dancing, and just general laughter. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a smartphone in sight. You know, in that space, I sat at the piano and we had the most amazing time. They became 25 again. They danced together. And I was, you know, the brief was to go and play. That was the well-being activity coordinator's brief. Go and play for our folks. What they did was they turned it into a period of movement, singing, entertainment, humour, laughter. And they skipped off to dinner at 6 o'clock. I was only there to play from 5 till 6. They skipped off to dinner, full of life, having been invigorated. It's almost like I mean, I've just been charging my mobile phone. It's like I supercharged them. And they plugged straight in to what I was doing. It didn't matter, actually, if I sat down and played Queen or Robbie Williams or Puff Daddy or Adele. They were just enjoying the execution of live music by a person who can play a tune. And they appreciated the tune. The fact that they happened to know the tunes was what sort of initiated the activity. They got up. I played the Charleston. I played In the Mood. I played Rock Around the Clock. I played I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. My Old Man Said Follow the Van. And they went away hoarse from singing. You know, it's probably the quietest dinner, Valentine's dinner they've ever had, because none of them had any voices because they'd all shouted. They'd all sung so much. But there you are. That, you know, that's the world.
They could have done another hour.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about, like, the creativity and the interaction around music that sometimes is lost nowadays. And I do find that, it was really, I was just explaining to Chris, actually, it's still a bit raw, so I don't know how to talk about it on this podcast, but I'll try and do it in the most sort of best way I can. But basically, I've just been in a competition, and I didn't get through to the final, and I was the only one that was playing the piano live out of most of the people. But I got some good feedback from one of the judges, Steve Edwards, who's a professional musician and singer. And me and my friend were listening to I put up a post yesterday. I was a bit upset, and one of the other contestants messaged me and said, "Are you okay?" And he had got through. And the interesting thing was I went on his profile and started to play a song that he was singing, and I showed my friend, and it was Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen. I heard there was a secret chord that David played in Please the Lord, and it's like we started singing it, and suddenly later on he got out his guitar and he said, because I was saying, "Oh, I don't know what to sing for the podcast, and you know, I don't, all this stuff. I'm not going to sing Hallelujah, but unless you want to play it, and then I'll sing along." But basically, he had his book out, and he said, "Oh, that's what I've been playing all week. You know, what a coincidence!" And he starts playing it, and so I start singing, and it was just this moment of connection. Musicians playing, singing, and I sort of realized this sort of like almost like a divine plan. I can't really describe it, but almost like it was the music telling me, like, this is what it's about, this is where you're supposed to be, this is the music. You know, I've just been I've got some cards coming out that I'm creating with an artist, and one of them says, "You are the music." And it's about sometimes if we don't get on the outside kind of that validation of like, yes, I'm good enough and I can win and all these things, but actually music isn't about that. Music isn't about winning, it's about collaboration and sharing. So it's just been a great learning for me of kind of what it's really about and why I'm here, and to really that's what I loved about what you were saying about you were with the musicians, and not the musicians, sorry, they could be musicians, but the people that you were with, was it a care home that you said you were with? Yeah, at the care home. And it was like you were playing with them and they were enjoying the music, and it's about that interaction, it's about that feedback that you get when you're sort of with others and you're singing kind of as a community.
Yeah, it's a shared experience.
Well, I wonder whether it might be fun to share a bit of experience with our listeners. I've got a few jazz standards for you, Lincoln. This is just to see if we get some extent to your great piano experience. So can you give us a few bars of Honeysuckle Rose?
Oh! Don't buy sugar, you just have to touch my cup. You're my sugar, it's so sweet when you stir it up. When I'm taking sips from those tasty lips, seems the honey fairly drip. You're not the flesh, goodness knows, cause you're my honeysuckle. Never knows.
different mood, night and day.
Good one, Chris. Yeah, like that.
Right, a little bit harder now. Shadow of Your Smile.
Oh, now you've got me there. I don't know that one without the music.
You need the music for that one.
I'll pass on that one.
Yeah, right. Have you got any tunes, Gemma? You...
What? God, you're putting me on the spot. Do you know Dream a Little Dream?
Yes.
Yeah. Can I maybe sing? I don't know if it'll work. I love you, dream a little dream. Day 99 and kiss me. Cross over time and tell me you'll miss me. When I'm alone and blue as can be.
Yeah. I see I'm going to be coming up to Yorkshire to do some gigs.
Yes. We look forward to that. So shall we move on to Lincoln's story? Carry on taking it away.
Well, folks, I wanted to. This story is not about music; it's about people. In 2009, just to give a little bit of background, I've been doing weddings for 43 years, and in 2009. In my role at Wilterbury Park as civil ceremony coordinator, basically I make sure that people have the credible music that they want for their civil ceremony in the right context, in a tasteful style, with the right sort of presentation. And I talk about pros, I talk about vows, I talk about clothes. I talk about guests. I talk about politics. Now, with that thrown into the mix, here comes bride and groom. He is a Jewish boy from Manchester. Jewish weddings, civil weddings, Jewish weddings involve a rabbi who sings 11 or 12 songs as part of the ritual of the marriage. I won't get into the detail of that. And then on the other hand, you've got an Indian girl from Milton Keynes, who's Hindu. And Lincoln is tasked. I saw this couple with their parents walk in to our atrium at Wilterbury Park. And I thought, right, I want to get into this as soon as possible. And I'm glad that I did. And my job was to be the pianist for the ceremony, to be the master of ceremonies for the whole day. So basically I was Mr. Continuity, because you've got two parties. You've got the Jewish party, who would like their faith and their culture to be represented. And you've got the Indians and the Hindu faith, who also want to be celebrated and represented. And there's always that sort of balance between, I mean, any family, there's the power. There's the power. The fight for power. And you put the man of colour in the middle of the two of them and nobody argues, because I am as neutral as they possibly can get. Afro-Caribbean, British-born Lincoln from sunny Northampton sits in the middle of the Jewish fraternity and the Hindu crowd. So, get to it. Lincoln goes to meet bride and groom, who live in a flat in Brent Cross in northwest London, and gets the general synopsis of the ceremony. And she ends up having which is nice and straightforward. And they leave to which is even more fantastic, because even 43 years later, they are still the tunes that I play the most for ceremonies. So if there's anybody listening that's getting married and says, well, they don't have that anymore, wrong. people push and shove about, we're going to be different, we're going to do this, we're going to do what's never been done before. The theme tune to Austin Powers, Another One Bites the Dust. Can I come into Rocky? When the bride's mother walks in, can you play Who Do You Think You Are Kidding, Mr. Hitler? Can I play the Jaws theme? Yes, I can do all of those things, and I've done all of those things. But when the bride comes down the aisle with her Say Yes to the Dress outfit, she looks like a bride. She has Here Comes the Bride. He is wearing a frock coat with a cravat and a stiff collar. He looks like a groom. He's Jewish, for God's sake, but he looks like a groom. If you're walking past, you would say, there's a bride and a groom. That's what you see. A bride and a groom. She's Indian and he's Jewish. She's brown, he's white. But it's a girl and a boy. You look at the frock and you say, oh, that's a nice frock. You don't say, oh, there's an Indian girl wearing a dress. You don't look at him and say, well, he's very, very handsome. You definitely don't say, well, there's a Jewish boy wearing a suit. I digress. That is the standard bit. I go off to Manchester to meet mum and dad. It's 120 miles, 2 hours in the car. I go to Manchester a lot. So it's not unusual for me to travel in all sorts of directions. And we have a chat, and mum emphasizes the need for the Jewish aspect to be represented. And I tell her, that's going to be absolutely fine. I drive to Milton Keynes to meet Dad, who's something in politics, and he wants to let me know at every sniff and cough that he's something in politics. Because at the end of the day, this is going to be his day, because he's going to give his daughter away, I'm going to introduce him, and he's going to talk for 6 minutes of nonsense about how wonderful his daughter is, as if she is the only girl on this earth who's ever got married, which is the father of the bride's prerogative. So we get all that down, and the trusty clipboard is taking all the notes. And then I go and meet the Hindu priest, who happens to be by day a minicab driver in Southall in northwest London. So we have a chat. He's in between jobs, and he tells me what he's going to do. Look, Indian weddings are a mystical event between you and me, but don't quote me, beyond this podcast, but most of them make it up as they go along. Now, I've been doing weddings for a very long time, and I know this, and I let him know that I know how it works. So tell me the mystical stuff that I don't understand, but I do understand, because I've done weddings a long time. We're going to eat sweets. We're going to burn a fire. He's going to make it up as he goes along. And then he smiles and he says to me, can you make sure there's a bottle of Budweiser backstage for me? And I said, of course I can. You are the priest. And whilst you're up front, you are as ecclesiastical as you possibly can be. But backstage, you're just like the rest of us. You want a crafty taste of a bit of Budweiser to oil the wheels of your existence. Absolutely fine. Off to Teddington Lock I go to meet the Jewish rabbi, who is actually a magazine owner. He owns magazines like Gramophone, and I believe one of the car magazines. I think it was What Car. So I come away with a free subscription of Gramophone, What Car, and 23 CDs of opera singers, pianists, chamber musicians. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, he and I are sat in his Teddington Lock office, which is actually the same location as Teddington Studios, that Chris will remember, where those great Morecambe and Wise TV shows were filmed. And he and I go through 10, 11 Jewish tunes. He's nervous about singing. People forget this, that he's nervous too. It's not just the bride and groom that are terrified. It's not just the father of the bride who's worried about his 6 minutes of speech. Are there too many jokes? Is it serious enough? Does it have enough integrity? They always ask me these questions. I'm just the bloke who plays the piano who's going to say, ladies and gentlemen, may I... Lincoln, can I just run this past you, please? I get this all the time. This is the bit that people don't realise. I'm there in this fantastic tuxedo, shiny shoes, piano tie. I look even handsome, Gemma, than I look now. But people think that I'm just going to just... No, Lincoln, can I just have a word? I just want to run this... Mr. Teddington Locke, and this is a man that's worth quite a bit of cash. He doesn't have to go out to lock his car. He does it on his phone. That's how powerful he is. He's got that much money. And he's terrified about singing 11 songs from his faith. But we get it all rattled. And by 7:45, I'm back on the South Circular and the North Circular and the M25 and the M1. And I'm back in sunny Northampton before Phil and Holly have started to roll the credits for this morning. A good morning's worth, I said to myself. Roll on the big day, which happened to be a Sunday. 12 o'clock kickoff. I hasten to add that in the morning, I was godfather at a christening. But that's another set of politics to deal with for when I'm invited back for the next podcast. I digress. I move on. We do the ceremony. It goes well. I play brilliantly. I always do. The ladies do what the ladies do. They compare outfits. They moan. They talk about each other. The men talk about sport and ask the important questions. Do you know what lager they serve here? We do the ceremony. Then we do the Jewish ceremony. It goes swimmingly. There are 300 people present. Whittlebury Park has the capacity to seat 300 people. It's one of the great appeals of the venue, with a grand piano for me to play. We then have refreshments and we disappear to the atrium, which can hold 700 people at a squeeze. Drinks are served. So the Jews can have wine and the Hindus can have fruit juice. And then when the ceremony is about to start, I make the decision to put all the drinks in the centre of the table so that nobody can be offended by anybody drinking alcohol. Everybody agrees. Ceremony happens. Then the father of the bride does his speech. The jokes are funny. The serious moments are emotional. I tip him the wink, and his chest explodes with pride. His wife tells him that she loves him. Everything's on track. Everybody's happy. The groom is funny. He's endearing. He's honest. He's frank. He's a little bit vulgar. But hey, we're having a good time. And the best man decimates his character, which is what best men are there for. We have the meal. A gentleman called Farouk Engineer. Now, Jeremy, you won't know who this chap is, but he was once the captain of Pakistan and he plays for Lancashire. And because they're from Manchester, he comes down for the wedding. But he doesn't want to walk in just like any guest. I am summoned to the door and he said, Lincoln, can you announce that I am here? The way this man entered the room, I might as well have said, the Prime Minister of Pakistan is in the building. Because as he walked in, he kissed women, shook hands and hit skin with guests. He kissed babies. It was almost like he was on an election campaign. And he took his seat. And being a show pony myself, I knew the right thing to do was to pull out his chair and push it in as he sat his considerable derriere on his seat and then clapped his hands as if he was in a seven-star restaurant in Dubai at £1,000 a head, and his starter was served. On it went. We had a fabulous time. And then the DJ, a gentleman from the Indian culture who had a list of tunes that he needed to play. Don't play this one because it will upset this person, and this person will upset that person. And he looked at me and said, I'm going to start the dancing off with this tune. And it was an absolute masterstroke. I said, yes, go for it. The bride and groom had done their first dance, and that second tune, it's the one that gets the party started. We've got people who are Jewish. We've got people who are Hindu. I hasten to add, there were lots of Africans there. There were lots of Afro-Caribbeans there. There were lots of Irish people there. There were lots of members of Middle England British society. And we had to be really careful. We didn't want to leave anybody out and insult anybody. So that tune came on. It absolutely flooded the dance floor. And you'll never guess what tune it was. It started like this. First I was afraid. I was petrified. And I thought, you know what? I've been all the way to Manchester. I've been all the way to Milton Keynes. I've been to London four times because I went to see the bride and groom twice. There was all this tiptoeing on eggshells. And then when it came down to it, all they wanted to dance to was I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor. I played that at Crispin's Working Men's Club, a social club. I played it at Semelong Working Men's Club. I played it at Windsor Castle when I played and the Queen was there. I played it for the Duchess of Rutland and the Indians and the Jews after all this pushing and shoving. That's all they wanted to dance to. And I thought, there you go. At the end of the day, it was a boy and a girl. And guess who was the first person on the dance floor? The 92-year-old grandmother, Indian grandmother, that they were scared of upsetting. She dragged her husband on and she sang the intro to her husband as if it was some sort of announcement. And as the song started, oh, now go, walk out the door. She poked him in the belly button and I turned to my friend and I said, there you go, there you go. That is called integration.
Thank you. And it's a song that's popular with our Prime Minister, apparently.
can you do it a bit more? And can I sing it with you? I don't know if it works on here. I don't know what the sound's going to be like.
Neither do I. But underneath Lincoln, it says warning in bright red. But everything seems to be working, so give it a try.
It says, do not approach with women and children.
I was petrified. Can't believe I could never leave you without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking I've been doing wrong, and I grew strong. I learned how to get along, and so you're back.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how that will sound, but
it might be like two different, like.
Well, I think it's a bit difficult when you're in two different places, but we'll see how it goes. Yeah,
we'll see how it goes. That was such a pleasure to sing with you, even if it doesn't sound correct on the podcast.
We enjoyed ourselves.
We enjoyed it. I was trying to get a video, but the thing is, I have no storage on my phone. So basically, because it would have worked on the video, you see, because the timing would be right, because you could hear you and you could hear me, and it would promote the podcast. So I could give a little clip and just say, listen to the podcast, look who we've got on. But the thing is that my phone is just messing about today. So there's no space. So I don't know whether I'll have got anything, but thank you so much. And I loved your story. What a great topic about, you know, the mixtures of cultures. And also, I'm also Jewish, part of my background, part Jewish. So that was a joy to hear. Not that I know much about the culture very much, having just been brought up pretty much British, but it is part of my background and heritage and all that stuff. So yeah, it was a joy, and I love Hinduism as well. So it was just like, oh, okay, and Afro-Caribbean. I just love the whole.
It's interesting.
It's great.
It's interesting, isn't it? How the wedding culture, as from what Lincoln's been telling us, is somehow sort of floating above. It doesn't matter what religion you are,
right. You
still know you're at a wedding by the look of it, at least. And the ceremony and then the reception and you know, all of that, you couldn't really see any difference between.
So can I ask a question? So when you were describing like their outfits and stuff, so am I right in saying that they didn't wear their traditional, because if you went to a Hindu wedding, for example, you would know it was a Hindu wedding because they dressed the outfit.
No,
you went to a Jewish wedding, you did wear a
sari. She did wear a sari. It's funny, I didn't want to get into too many details, otherwise I'd still be telling the story now. Yes, she did wear a sari, and he did change off into another outfit. So I was a little bit naughty, because actually that's quite important. They wore the frock coat and the bridal gown, and then they changed into the Indian wardrobe, and then they changed back for the wedding breakfast into the wedding dress in the formal suits. But I mean, I've been a church organist, I've been playing in church. I mean, my first wedding in 79 was on the piano in church. All my weddings from 1979 to 1991 were in church. And there's we talking about the Hindu ceremony and the Jewish ceremony. For many English people, the Church of England, Baptist, Methodist, Free Church congregational ceremony is as mystical as anything else, because in reality most people don't go to church. So there is an element of trepidation when people step into church. There's an element of trepidation when people step into a civil ceremony, because I'm doing civil ceremony. I'm doing a wedding on average once a week, probably twice a week. If I, this year I may do 100 weddings, so that is effectively two a week. So it's second nature to me to see the scenario, which is one of the reasons why I've sort of written the book, because I've created a online course for couples who are getting married to say, right, this is the way, these are the things to consider before you make your decisions based on 1,200 ceremonies, 1,200 specific civil ceremonies. And I can say this works, doesn't work, and this is a good idea, this is very definitely a bad idea. In theory, this sounds, but don't entertain it for these reasons. I can't tell a person what to do and what not to do. I just give them the information so that they can make an informed decision. It is their day at the end of the day. I call weddings the one-day Olympics, because there's a lot of pushing and shoving that goes on before the big day, and then it goes. It's like a firework. You think about the firework displays we have on New Year's Eve. There's some extraordinary stuff that goes up with drones and in the sky And once they've sparked, they've gone. That's it. They just smoke. And weddings are a little bit like that. That's not to say that it's a waste of money. I would never tell anybody that they have wasted their money on a wedding day, because people are into experiences. People want experiences. You know, we as creatives are creating experiences. People spend a lot of money. I mean, I'm a big football fan. People spend a lot of money following their football teams. People spend a lot of money following, you know, the Six Nations is on as we're recording this. You know, the Calcutta Cup, England went to Italy. I know a lot of people that travel to Italy for the experience of, you know, 30 men chasing a ball in the shape of an egg. If you describe it like that, you wouldn't go out your front door, but it's all about the experience, the build-up, the atmosphere, the community singing, the corporate, the funny stories from the ex-professionals, the pundits in the studios, the presenters, the TV crews. There's a whole thing. So weddings are an opportunity for good old-fashioned Middle England foot soldiers. That's why ordinary people, I don't say they're boring, nor ordinary Middle England foot soldiers have their day in the sun. It's their greatest day. And no day is as great as their wedding day. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whatever happens. If you're a movie star and you wear great clothes and you earn great money, that experience is magical, apart from, of course, becoming a parent.
I just thought, because you said ordinary people. Do you know the song Ordinary People?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
We're just ordinary people.
Yeah. There was a time when I probably played that absolutely. Yeah. It's still a default tune that I will play. Mm-hmm. Although, funnily enough, I didn't play it yesterday. After I played for my senior citizens, I went to a couple close to Huntingdon near Cambridge, who had a chef who came in and cooked for them, and I played the piano for them as they dined at their dining table, and I played a whole load of stuff. But I didn't play Ordinary People. But then romance means different things to different people. There was the two of us, sorry, the three of us, the four of us, the chef, myself, and David and Armand, and their four dogs, who had their own take on the scenario. So, I mean, you know,
what about just the two of us?
Yeah, played that, Bill Withers, yeah. Mm-hmm. That did happen. I did play How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, and Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow. and Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Don't analyse it. It's just what happens in the moment.
Yes.
Expect that one.
I think we possibly need to, we need to move on.
We need to go to the next section. Yes. But thank you.
Well,
it's so much good stuff.
And I think it's. I think we may find the theme carrying on through this, because what I want to talk about is marginalia. Somebody said, I didn't know there was a word for that." And strictly speaking, marginalia is when you make a note in a book. So you're reading a book and you think, I'll underline that paragraph, and I'll put, and particularly if you write something alongside of it in the margin. And it's not a modern invention at all. It goes back really into history, deep history, prior to printing. When all the books were written by hand, obviously the temptation to put a little commentary in the margin was there. And I wonder how much, when you look at particularly religious texts like the Bible, how much of it actually started as somebody putting it in the margin, and then somebody else came along to copy it and incorporated it into the main text. So that would have been important. But also, apparently, quite a lot of the beautiful manuscripts that you sometimes see, when you look at the marginalia, it's actually quite rude. I'm fed up with writing this. I'll draw a little picture in the margin or whatever. So and I was thinking, I'm doing a writing challenge, so I have to write a story every weekday for 4 weeks, and I'm on to week two now, so it's number seven today, and so I thought, how can I approach this? And I thought, I've read a lot of books, certainly more than 20 or 21 books over my lifetime. I've read hundreds of books, and I thought it might be good because those books sort of occupy the margin of my life. It's not very often a book really becomes part of the your mainstream story. They're all things, and it's the same with tunes and music and so on. But that doesn't mean they don't have an influence. And I thought to explore that would be interesting. And the other thing about marginalia is that, particularly since the printing press and the print of books, that's meant that more and more books have become available, but the author isn't available, often because they've died decades or even centuries ago. But even if they're still alive, it's not always easy to make contact with them. But marginalia is part of a debate between the reader and the author, and that's how it's used. I think it's particularly interesting in the Jewish tradition, and I'll probably get these words wrong and people will send me letters if I do, but one of the concepts in Judaism is Midrash, which is the commentary on the texts of the Torah or Talmud. And the way the Midrash is published, if you imagine a page, you put the verse from the Talmud or Talmud in the center of the page, and then divide the page into segments. And in each segment, there's a commentary from a famous rabbi from history. So you get the original text and then a number of different views, which might even be contradictory around it. And one of those segments is left blank for the reader. So there's actually an encouragement to join in the debate. And I think that's a marvellous image, because so much religion is fundamentalist as one way of interpreting this particular text, and no other way is allowed, and so on. But the idea that the text is something that might have come from God many thousands of years ago, but now it belongs to us, and we can use it and work with it in any way that we choose, because the text itself doesn't change.
It's a little bit like social media, because social media is all about people committing their viewpoints on any given subject. You know, somebody puts a post, so you could put a text and then everybody sort of comments. So it's just it's really social media ahead of its time, Chris.
Yeah, well, maybe that's it. Social media is marginalia. It's on the margins of our lives, or should be.
Should be.
Yeah. Although you get the impression that some people sort of live for it. Usually people who were, sort of failed politicians and whatever.
I use it a bit too much. But yeah, it's I like what you're saying about how something can be written, but then you can actually add to it or maybe not add to it, but like give it your own perspective or kind of comment or, just have that kind of dialogue. It makes it a dialogue rather than just a monologue, where you can write about it. And I like to read books where, because I'm reading a lot of kind of spiritual books at the moment, where they kind of encourage you to, they'll tell you some certain things and then it says ask yourself these questions. So it's kind of like, it might be a question like, how are you going to put in, make these changes in your character, and what are the values that you hold, and things like that. So then I'm there in my notebook putting like, okay, these are the things that I think are what I want to bring into my life. And I think that's a really good thing to encourage people to.
Well, I suppose journaling is a, you know, you could see it as a species of marginalia, or that all these things are sort of part of a continuum. But the writing challenge, I'll just give you a couple of examples. The prompt yesterday was a love letter. I wonder why that was. Yeah. Well, I'm the least romantic person you'll ever meet. I think that's so. I never sent a successful Valentine remotely, and I only ever received one. And I only found it several weeks after Valentine's Day. It was just this piece of paper with a sticker heart in the middle of it. So I never quite conclusively worked out who that was from. So, as far as, you know, I'm single, and my guide to relationships is Groucho Marx, who said that he'd never want to be the member of a club that would have him as a member. So that was. But I wanted to incorporate a book into it because that's the challenge, and I chose Philip Pullman's Northern Lights because that is a very moving love story. You don't expect that when you start out on volume one, but by the time you get to the end, have you read it, Gemma? You know what I'm talking about. All right. But the one of the things about fantasy and science fiction is that it gives you an opportunity to, how would people respond if they were put in this impossible situation? And a lot of tragic love stories are where one or the other dies. But what happens if you're both alive, but have no way of reaching one another? And it ends with a bench in, I think it's an Oxford college, and both their worlds, because they're from different parallel worlds. And they agree to sit on the bench on a particular date at a particular time every year. And that's how it finishes. And Philip Pullman's now writing another trilogy in the same universe as Lyra, the main protagonist. And I'm hoping that he doesn't find a way to bring them back together, because it would so spoil that ending. So I'm a little bit of a softie, even though I'm totally unromantic. And today's challenge is a letter of complaint. Can be different from a love letter, and I'm part way through that. I know what I want to talk about, because I think a lot of people get confused about what complaints are. And I used to work for about a year. I worked for a business where handling complaints was really important, but it was really important to know when you had a complaint and when you had something else. So I'm going to write about that, but I've still not found a book for that yet. So but I'm telling you this because I'm in the middle of a creative process, and it's that daily challenge of coming up with ideas and then expressing them that I find really, really helpful.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're moving on to the next part where I'm going to sing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. So this is a song called From Me to You, and it is a love song, but it's also a song about letting go of anything that is sort of not necessary from the past, and also expressing our true voice as well, because that is kind of the work, well, it is the work that I do, is encouraging people to find their voice, what matters to them, what's important to them. So, yes.
There's a voice inside our hearts that we can't deny is ours. There's a strength inside our foes we don't need to hide anymore, and there is nothing, nothing. day, and there's nothing, nothing at all in my way. Let this moment be past of everything I never asked of you. You are the reason, you are the truth. There's nothing left to say, but I love you, simple and true. From me to you, I see you. There's a voice inside our hearts, but for a while it can seem like words and stories. Not alone, but search for stars. Am I the one who's capable to explore these? Nothing, nothing at all that I won't show you today. And there's nothing, nothing at all in my way. Let this moment be past of everything I never asked of you. You are the reason, you are the truth. There is nothing left to say, but I love you, simple and true. From me to you.
Yes. So, how did you come up with the idea for the song?
Well, I'm always really embarrassed explaining how I come up with ideas of songs sometimes, because often they're about ex-partners. Mm-hmm. But the song is not actually about... So, basically, I was about to have a breakup with this person, but I didn't know at the time that that was the case. But we were getting to the end of the relationship. But for some reason, I just was inspired to write a couple of love songs. And I think the message behind them is that my love is eternal for anyone, really. I mean, he hurt me quite badly, so I don't want to kind of make it about him, because apparently he had a lot of stuff going on that he... I don't know, resentment or whatever. I don't know that he felt to say some things that were quite hurtful. So, but my message is that I love you. So whether someone hurts me or not, that love is eternal, and I will never change. It will never change. And whether someone's with me or not, I will always love them. It's a bit like I Will Always Love You, Whitney Houston. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like, That's kind of the message, almost a little bit of the message. It's like, let this moment be past of everything I never asked of you, and just say I love you, because they're the only three words that matter in this moment.
That's actually really interesting, isn't it? Because I mentioned Philip Pullman's Will and Lyra, and I was saying that fantasy often puts people into situations they'd never be in. But that's true on one level. I mean, we don't normally meet people from parallel worlds. But on another level, it's a very common experience where there's some sort of breakup, but the love continues.
Yeah.
And that might be, it may be the death of one of the partners, which is obviously a very final thing, but it can also be where there's a breakup and... they're not emotionally not in the same place. So that would be a one-sided. I suppose you can be separated. People going to war, for example.
Yeah, so. It's a really funny dynamic, actually. I still haven't really figured out what that all was about. But at the same time, I know for me, it's always been about the music. Music is my first love. So, and I think he knew that. And that's why we broke up, I think, because he said, you know, you need to go and live your dreams. And I think he could tell I wasn't fully, my love was somewhere else in terms of my love was for the music. But we connected on that level as well. We connected through the music. And I think that's where, you know, the greatest romance can often be, is through music.
I think it's fascinating hearing won the song hearing to you trying to explain the process. I think that what I've discovered, having got to this point of being married, and let's say happily married, my wife might be listening in the other room and beg to differ. I think my wife was having a very deep discussion with two other ladies about being married to me and marriage and how relationships work. And sometimes, like the music, you create great music. I was actually thinking of Beverly Craven when I listened to you. She did and like your intro is very similar, and it kind of went in accompaniment style. You actually were so committed to the song that it actually didn't matter how you were playing the song. It was all about the song. And sometimes, and this is, I suppose, this is the advantage that I have as an older person in this space, is that you always have to justify yourself to other people who don't understand where you are, what you do, and how it works. If you're in a relationship, this is where I have to be very thankful to my wife, because I'm sure she has to defend me to other people. You know, it could be Saturday afternoon and I'm going off to play a wedding, and then 2 hours later, these fabulous pictures emerge on social media of me surrounded by girls who look their most fabulous best. And she gets messages and says, "Oh God, your Lincoln is surrounded by three young ladies who are throwing themselves at him." And she sees it for what it is. And that is part of the process of interaction with people and sharing their great day with them and making them feel the best they can feel. You're creating music, and it's not 17 units equals £10 each or £12.50. It's just music. You don't sit down and go, right, I've done this many notes, I now need to sell this many copies. You don't think about that when you write a song. It just comes out. And so I would say, I'm not being facetious when I say this now. I was working 4 Christmases ago with Eddie Mannion, and he's a member of the E Street Band for Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce Springsteen struggles to explain the songs that he's written. He just knows that they happened. And when you're talking to the boys, you know, how does this happen? Why is it successful? Sometimes you can't. I'm sure there are many cynics out there, and I will put my hand up and say that I've been one of them. Look at a person like Ed Sheeran and say, why are you successful when there are so many guys just like you on open mic nights who are doing exactly what you do, and they're not getting anywhere. They're struggling to get 10 people to listen, and you're where you are, and you're making the money you're making, and everybody who doesn't know anything about music thinks that you're the best thing since sliced bread. He doesn't know. He just writes what he writes. And I think that success, to come back to your original question when you were reading the notes about my career, how does that make you feel? I never thought when I was doing whatever I was thinking, right, I'm going to do this because this will look good on my CV, and I'm doing this because, you know, when I meet that gorgeous Gemma sometime in my life, this will look good on my CV. And you do what you do, and when you look back, you know, we have, I should say, Piers Morgan, it's now the lady from GMTV that does the show, and they get a famous person, they go through their life, and they psychoanalyze the whole process, and it's easy to look back on things that you've done and say, this is what we did, this is how we did it, and this is what the process was. Sometimes you're so involved that it's better to be involved and create what you create and let it come out at the other end of the funnel, good, bad, or indifferent. And the rest of the world has to be open enough, although it isn't, of course, to say, this is what has been produced. This emotion came from wherever. This strikes a chord with me because I feel this I can relate to this song because that was me 3 days ago, 3 years ago, 30 years ago, 5 minutes ago. And that's, I think that's the beauty of creativity. You can't get a barometer and say that it makes this much money or it creates this much feeling or the statistical evidence is. It is what it is.
Yeah, and that's the distinction between paid work and real work that I make. Because paid work, you need to think about your market. So, you know, how do you get appointments to play at weddings and what tunes do you play that will please the people in the weddings? Real work is where you think about yourself. Or maybe don't even think about yourself. You think about the work. it's that creative. And you can't be creative if you're thinking about what will please other people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't...
I think you can, sometimes, just because I'm just going to tell a quick story. Sorry, I interrupted Duncan, but I just...
Yeah.
I tell this story sometimes because I think it's helpful for people that feel... Sometimes, I'm sure you felt this, maybe Lincoln, where you're such a... If you're a creative person, you want to do what you want to do, and then you think, well, why do I have to do this song if it's for these people? But the thing is that one time I was teaching dancing, and I wanted to do a certain song. I can't even remember the song I wanted to do the dance to. I thought it fit the theme. And then my boss at the time, the dance person who owned the dance school, said, Gemma, you're going to do Cats. And I said, Cats? That's not the song I wanted to do. and then I started complaining to my other colleague. And I was like, why are we doing Cats? Well, I didn't want to do Cats. And then she said, I said to her, I feel stifled. I feel like I'm not able to do what I creatively want to do. And then she said, well, why don't you be creative within Cats? And then suddenly I just realized, I went, yeah, I'm going to do Cats. And it was the most creative, one of the most creative dances I've ever choreographed. Because I got them to do like lifts and everything. And then afterwards the show, everyone was like, wow, that Cats number, so creative. And it's like, so you can actually, I don't know, Lincoln, if you can explain
the constraints want. Often are there, but it's not about pleasing the person who sets the constraints. The writing challenge I'm doing, I get a prompt every day from someone who knows nothing about my thought knows a bit about my thought processes, but quite a lot of people are doing the same challenge. It's about being creative within those constraints, and that often helps, but that's not the same as pleasing people.
it's about understanding the it's about understanding the, let's talk about the process of business, because there's playing music and then there's being in the music business. And you have to, after you've created your song, you put it in a box and then you look at it as a product. I remember listening to an artist who turned down a massive contract with Apple, who wanted to use their music and pay them a lot of money. And Apple said, yep, what we're going to do is we're going to use your content for this. And the guy who was in the band said, my stuff's not content. It's not content. It's my creative energies. It's my creative sinews. But this is where we as creatives have to be very, very careful, because the bean counters may inadvertently be clumsy about the way they deal with the product. And we have to be very, very sensitive about how we describe the what has been produced in the package. The package is not an amoeba. It's not a thing that goes in a carrier bag. It's not a thing that goes in a Amazon box that the man in the van delivers at between 10 and 11 or 11 and 11:15. It's not that. It's something else. But as Chris says, there are certain constraints because there has to be order in the world and somebody has to be referee. And that person, most of the time, is very unpopular because what they're trying to do is put the tram lines down to say, because they've got to go and represent whatever it is. And I think if you, the big challenge about being a professional musician is understanding how all of those components come together to be able to make a living, to then wake up the next day and do the same thing again. That's the bit that is hard to explain to people who don't understand. Being a professional musician is not about getting four yeses from Simon Cowell and Amanda Holden and David Williams and whoever, I forget the other young lady who's the singer. You know, these people are not experts. I remember when Pop Idol first came along, they had experts of the industry. Mm-hmm. They got it completely wrong. What they're actually creating is a TV show because, you know, Bob and Eileen and their two kids, Trevor and Donna, are actually just watching a show. They're not bothered about the integrity of the artist. They're not worried about the coloratura of the phrasing of Gemma's singing. They don't care about her breath control. They just are sitting there with their Just Eat meal on their lap, watching a gorgeous girl in a young frock who might sell a few tickets in their local theatre and they might go along because they've seen her on Britain's Got Talent or Pop Idol, and it's as simple as that. And that's where we creatives mess ourselves up because we get so obsessed with what we've produced. We forget to package it, sell it, and market it because the Donnas and the Bobs and the Eileens are the people who actually dip into their pockets or they get their credit cards out and go on the website and click the link and give you the 30 quid so they can stand at the back of Wembley Stadium and see the little dot that's you on the stage and pay for an overpriced Coke and a burger just to hear that very thing that made them cry in the living room when they were eating their Just Eat meal. And this, once you accept, don't understand it, just accept that this is the way it works, then you strike gold and you say, right, okay, this is what it is. Because with weddings per se, what I do is I say, right, I have a certain set of parameters that I work with. If I can work with those parameters, I'm happy with the gig. If you say to me, right, we've got a list of songs for you to play, Lincoln, we want you to play these songs, then I'm not that man. Because I'm a person who plays music in the moment. I know Bride's going to come down to this and go out. But the magic of Lincoln is that Lincoln inserts what works in a given moment at any time. If you stop Lincoln doing that, then you don't get the best of Lincoln. And if a person, this is what I've learned from doing weddings. If a person wants to micromanage every note and tune I play, then I say to that particular person, I don't care if I'm getting 10 million for this job. I am the wrong man. Call the next person who's in your notebook because he might be happy to take the money for less creative output. You get to an understanding of what works for you and makes you happy. The rest you don't explain to anybody. You, as long as you know in yourself, you're with the gentleman and he's decided he wants a girl who's going to be cooking his tea at 4:45 instead of poncing around with a guitar and a piano writing songs. I don't want to come in and she says to me, I've created a great song. I want to come in and I want her to say, we've got steak for tea and we've got Mediterranean baked beans. And he says, great, I'll go and put my coat down. I'll wash under my smelly armpits and I'll tell you that Bob in accounts was a pain in the arsehole today and you put your head on your side and go, ah, oh, bless. Oh, that, you know, these are the challenges that one faces How do you find Perfect Person? Don't you write your songs, and you write your songs about experiences. These experiences happen. It doesn't matter that you're a gorgeous girl and he wants your tea, you to be stood at the stove cooking his tea at 5:45. You just pick him up and put him in the recycle tub and you move on. And you have to accept, and this is the only life lesson you're going to get from me, because you get plenty from Chris. You have to accept, right, that somebody will love you and somebody will know your value when that time comes. You just have to move along and keep moving along. You know, like when you're scrolling through a page and you go, nope, 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 nope. I've gone through 732 pages. I'm bloody exhausted. Well, just keep going. Just keep writing. Keep producing. And then suddenly, bingo. And that moment where the 100 violins play and the man with the big belly hits the two cymbals together and the kettle drums go flash and your brain goes doolally, it comes when you least expect it. Chris will tell you that he and I met in a breakout room a good few, over a year ago on a Tuesday evening. I was eating my dinner and he was probably eating his. And I said to my wife, I'm going to go onto this Tuesday call with Zoe, or was it Nikki? Suddenly, Zoe. Bang, here we are. The man from Sheffield meets the maestro from Northampton, and here we are. People will say to Chris, that black guy from Northampton, he was your best podcast guest ever. How did you meet? And he said, well, Lincoln's in Northampton. They'll never get it. The most important thing is that we're here and we create the magic. And sometimes people overanalyze absolutely everything. Although, of course, we're here to talk about the stories. But sometimes some people get lost in their storytelling. That's why not everybody works as a storyteller. And that's why some people just, they get so obsessed with the chapter and the verse and the middle eight and the chorus and another chorus with a key change, with another instrumental break, which then goes to another key change. And by the time we get to the chorus that everybody wants to sing along to, they're fast asleep. And that's life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the creativity, is what I tell my clients, that when they're using stories, particularly for marketing purposes, it's actually entertainment. And that's really important, because if you don't engage with the audience, if the audience aren't thrilled and interested and engaged with what you're saying, then you're wasting your time. And it's that really positive positive embracing of the creative, and a good story will sell your business. It doesn't need anything else. But getting to a good story is the challenge, really. Anyway, time is flowing.
This is all golden. I think that even though we went over a bit today, I think that there's a lot of golden content in, well, I don't know if you call it content, creativity, whatever. So if you've listened to the end of this podcast and you've got to the end,
congratulations.
You are a star, and you probably like us. And want to be creative or something, do something in your life, tell a story or something, or you just enjoyed it and that's great. So how can people find out more about you, Lincoln?
Oh, goodness me. I'm on LinkedIn, LinkedIn under Lincoln Noel the Maestro. I am on Instagram, Tinklin Lincoln the Maestro. Tinklin does not have a G. Tinklin Lincoln the Maestro, all lowercase. I'm on TikTok, Tinklin Lincoln Maestro, and I sometimes appear in Clubhouse as well. And of course, I'm on Facebook. I think there's only 8 Lincoln Noels in the world. One of them passed away recently as a pan player in Trinidad and Tobago, but I can honestly say that I'm the best looking of all of them. So if you find a good looking Lincoln Noel, you'll know you've got the right guy. Lincoln Noel the Maestro, I've got a page, jump on there. There's also a page called Lincoln Noel Weddings and much, much more. And I've got a jazz trio. I haven't talked about the jazz trio, but I've got a really swinging jazz trio in the style of Oscar Peterson, although we have just added a sax player, so we're very like the Dave Brubeck quartet. The jazz standards that Chris fired at me, that's our main diet.
Yes, I thought it might be. You need to learn Shadow of the Smile, though.
It has been learned, but I know that you're going to throw it at me, and I know that I need to know it by next time when we're with our mutual girlfriend, Sarah English. So I'll probably have it on the wall off camera so that you can't see it, Chris. And you'll go, that Lincoln's done some extraordinary work.
but you're giving it away. So what about you, Gemma? Have you got anything new for people to find?
Yes. Actually, I will be doing some workshops very soon in March with my friend Charu. Hopefully, never know, she might come on the podcast. But we're going to do some workshops called Yours and Ours. So they're local to Sheffield. So if you're in Sheffield and you want to do some free workshops with me and Charu, we're going to do some Indian dancing, some contemporary dancing, maybe singing, poetry, who knows what we're going to do. It's going to be very creative, based on emotions, yours and ours. So that's coming up. And also I do Finding Your Voice sessions. So if you're interested in doing a Find Your Voice, either a one-on-one or a group workshop with me, then just drop me a message on my pages, which is Gemma Rosenthal on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and also creativehearts.coach is my coaching pages. So they're on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay. So yeah. So all these links will appear in the show.
Sorry. Now. I'm now also officially on Spotify, iTunes. You can check out my music. At the moment, there's only 3 songs on there, but there will be more. There's going to be albums coming, don't you worry. So yes, you can check out my music on YouTube, and that's Gemma Rosenthal as well.
Yes,
and all those platforms. It just keeps getting more and more. The more platforms I'm on, it's just more and more, and it's just a load of stuff. But obviously, they're in the show notes.
We'll make sure that the main ones are in the in the show notes. And I should say, I do offer coaching for business owners who want to have a go at using stories in their marketing, or using but also stories can help you with your business development, because they often uncover aspects of the business that you sort of knew but were sort of tucked away at the back of your head, and it helps you to bring them out and generally to become more creative. I'm also, as an experiment, on the 24th of February, which may be before or after you hear this podcast, I'm going to try doing an online workshop about finding stories, because that's one of the key skills to storytelling, is working out what stories you have and how to use them for your business. Because a bit of story, say, from childhood might not seem relevant to your business, but so how do you actually make it something that you can use to promote your business? So that's what that's going to be about. But if you have a look at the telling stories link in the show notes, you'll also see the storytellers for March, and it's quite an exciting program.
Also, make sure you check out the other episodes of the podcast.
Oh, yes.
We've had loads of fantastic guests, really insightful people and creatives on there. So, yeah, check out the other episodes, and thank you for listening.
Yeah. And thank you, Lincoln. And I'm rather hoping that Lincoln will be able to play us out.
Yes.
Oh, well, you see, I love The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book. It's absolutely my favourite. So I will say thank you very much, Gemma, Chris, for having me on the podcast. It's been great fun. We've probably had a lot of discussions that we probably didn't plan to have. But hey, That's the whole point about conversation, the art of good conversation.
It's always that way. That's the idea.
And thank you. So for the folks, this is the bare necessities. Look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your stripes. I mean, it's the bare necessities. It's my bare can rest these leprechaun necessities of life. Whenever I wander, wherever I roam, I couldn't be fonder of my Sheffield home. The bees are buzzing in the trees to make some honey just for me. When you look under those rocks and plant a deep glance at the fancy, maybe try a few. The bare necessities, the bare necessities, the bare necessities of life have come to me. You've been listening to the mic.
Yay!